Today on Against the Grain, emergent technologies have already altered our lives profoundly and promise to do so even more in the near future. From the smartphones most of us carry around, to 3D printing, to augmented reality like Pokemon Go. But these innovations are seen as a fact of life, part of the march of progress, rather than things that come with a steep price and that we should have political say over. I'll speak with critic Adam Greenfield about the hidden costs of these technologies. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. There was a time that new digital technologies, including the internet, were seen to hold a utopian promise. The horizontal nature of such technologies was to allow us to come together across our differences, access liberatory information, and lead to a better world. But the reality, as urbanist Adam Greenfield argues, has turned out quite differently. Emergent technologies have certainly changed our lives, but in ways that not only expose us even more directly to commercial interests and the state, but change our relationships with each other, with social and political consequences. Greenfield has worked as a lead information architect for the Tokyo office of Razorfish, as well as for Nokia in Helsinki. He's the author of Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life, published by Verso. Adam, why have digital technologies not fulfilled their utopian promise? Was that expectation wrong to start with?
It's a fantastic question, and I was one of those people that had an almost boundless and in retrospect, fairly naive hope in the technology, specifically of the internet, to do precisely what you said, to connect us in ways that were direct and unmediated by the structures that existed, at least in the 1990s. When the internet first became something that most of us engage in everyday life. I think what happened was that we misunderstood the nature of what this communications and mediation network was. I read a fantastic book maybe half a decade ago now called Protocol. And a guy named Alexander Galloway basically explains that, you know, we've been proceeding all along with this notion that the internet is radically flat, that it allows horizontal connections, direct and unmediated connections. And to proceed under that view of the world is to indulge in a misunderstanding of exactly how the internet works. It's actually made up of a stack of different layers that are mediated by different technical protocols. And one of those layers is indeed fairly horizontal. But the layer that sits on top of is insanely hierarchical, insanely centralized, implicitly controllable by a state that has access to the plug at any moment. And so even in that early way, by misunderstanding the technical details of what it was that we were using, we misunderstood the social, the psychic, the technical possibilities, the social, the psychic, and the political possibilities that grew out from it. And I think that's a really potent metaphor, and I guess that's what I'm trying to get after in my book. We need to understand just a little bit about the ways in which these devices and services and objects function if we are truly to understand what role they're going to play in our lives and how we'll be able to use them. In my case, I'm interested in using them for what we might have called progressive or liberatory ends. And so I'm very, very interested to see if there are any blind spots in my understanding of contemporary networked information technologies, if there are any other similar blunders that are out there waiting for me in my approach to these things. And that journey of exploration and understanding is what I've tried to share in the book. My rather gloomy conclusion, but I don't think it's inaccurate, is that certainly most of the technologies that have grown up and around the internet, the mobile phone networks that we use, the social network platforms that we interact in, have been completely captured by capital. And maybe even capture is a naive word. Maybe they were always already part and parcel of the contemporary late capitalist experience. And I just don't think that they can offer us the kinds of direct, unmediated, real connections that we dreamed into them at the beginning of this adventure, maybe 20 years ago.
Well, you're bringing up the term capture raises a question, which is that some of the criticisms leveled against the internet and the way that information technologies have been structured has been about the commercialization of these different forms. And it raises the question whether under a different social system, these technologies might function in a different way, or do you think there's something actually inherent to the technologies themselves? And you did say a moment ago that things are much more centralized than I think a lot of us had pictured, that there had been this notion that networks mean everything's horizontal and that's sort of the end of the story. Is there something, do you think, that is actually inherent in the technologies that would skew it in a certain direction, even if this all took place under a different social structure?
Well, I think a different social structure would definitely make things better. And if you're, you know, looking at it from a social democratic perspective, I think that the internet would probably be regulated as a public utility, and it would be better in that sense. But on a deeper level, I do believe that there are fundamental aspects of the ways in which we've built this network and allowed it to take up residence in our lives that tend to cut against that possibility. And I'll give you an example. When Apple introduced the iPhone 10 years ago now, and we're stipulating for the moment that obviously Apple is a commercial enterprise and they intend to make a profit on their products and services. When they introduced the iPhone, there was a possibility that they could have cut around the commercial carriers, cut around the AT&Ts and the T-Mobiles of the world entirely, and allowed the phones to connect with one another via something called ad hoc mesh networking, which would have been a truly horizontal platform for communication. It would have meant that there is essentially, you know, no centralized point of access, no centralized server. The phones would have made the network that they needed in real time. And I'm guessing that the decision that they made at that point in cultivating these corporate partners was that there simply weren't enough of the phones in the world, nor would there be for several years thereafter, for the kind of density that a mesh network requires to come into being. And so we embarked on this journey with the smartphone, where in many ways they're radical, but in many ways they're completely conventional. You still have a monthly contract with a carrier. You know, the carrier still, not in Apple's case particularly, but with other phones, the carrier can still push all kinds of branded content and you know, unnecessary junk onto the phone itself. And the carrier owns the data that you generate in the course of your using that device. And that just didn't need to be. There were other technical paths that we could have taken that I think probably would have produced an altogether different sense of what it meant to communicate with these things. And it isn't just the phones, right, as the physical platform. It's the social networks as well. It's the ways in which those organizations were funded. I happen to believe that technology development, you know, in our era, it isn't really funded by any other mechanism than venture capital anymore. And if there's one thing that we know about venture capitalists, it's that they're looking for high multiples and relatively near-term exits. And that skews the design of technological products and services in ways that are congenial to them and are not necessarily commensurate with the longer term or the different use of these platforms. Having said all of that, that our history with these devices and services is really radically contingent and it could have turned out differently, I have another sneaking suspicion, which is deeper still, which is that they do kind of take us out of ourselves. They do kind of remove us from the immediate physical environment that we're in. They entrain our intention in certain fairly unhealthy ways. And I just prefer to interact with people socially these days and leave my phone off or in a pocket or in a bag or out of sight. I do think that they entrain certain kinds of being in the world. And while it's not for me to judge what anybody else chooses to do with them, those are the kinds of being in the world that I just personally regard as kind of unhealthy and not the way that I want to live personally.
Well, let's stay with smartphones for a moment. you're touching on how they've changed everyday life. What beyond that would you say is crucial in thinking about the ways that smartphones have changed our relationship to the world around us politically, personally, socially, et cetera, commercially?
Yeah, the point that I try to always make is that this single device turns out to be the sort of sovereign mediator. It's the single interface between ourselves and the physical, social, even the political world these days. So much of our lives comes to us through the aperture of this one device that it does function as the commanding heights of certainly of everyday life and maybe even the economy. I ask people to, you know, when I meet them, you know, well, how did you get here? How did you get to the place where we're meeting? Well, maybe they looked at a transit app on their phone. And how did you know what to wear this morning? Well, I probably looked at the weather on my phone. And, you know, you kind of walk them back through the decisions that constitute everyday life. And, you know, some people even met their romantic partners through the apps that they have on their phone. It's an astonishing point of centralized access and possibly even control. And most of us simply aren't aware of that. So one of the things that I wanted to do in the book is really densely unpack this device, find out almost like one of those exploded views that you used to see in anatomy textbooks or in engineering books, like blow the thing up, follow each one of its components, follow each one of the services and the antennae that are on board the device and the sensors, and find out what each one of them implies for us and our ability to make sense of the world. And I personally find that an exciting thing to do. Like, it means that when I pick up a device, I can't ever, it's no longer settled. It's no longer matter of fact. To use Bruno Latour's expression, it's become a matter of concern. And really interestingly to me, it's become a site of interest and of contestation. I see something as seemingly simple as a smartphone as this roiling envelope of contests over who has access to what and on what terms, what trade-offs are made in guaranteeing that access. And that really is the fundamental and central point that I want to make, not merely as regards the smartphone, but as regards all these technologies that we're inviting into our lives, the wearable biometric monitors and the virtual assistants and the augmented reality devices and services. Each one of these things represents a trade-off, and they offer to us some convenience, some lightening of our burden, some way of engaging in the world that offers us something that we ostensibly did not have before. And in return, they take from us something. And all I've ever asked is that the terms of those bargains be made as explicit as possible so we can make informed choices as to whether or not we want to invite these things into our lives. So we can say, you know what, this bracelet that I wear every day that tells me how many footsteps I've taken and tells me what my heartbeat is, I get something out of that, but so does an insurance company, or so does a healthcare provider. And maybe I don't want them having that access. Maybe the cost of that access is too high. Maybe this device, while it seemingly offers me control over my own life, may offer some other party an even greater degree of control. And that is precisely the sort of bargain that slips beneath the surface in most of the coverage and most even of the discussion around emerging technologies. It's a little bit dismissive to say that coverage is invariably, shiny, but honestly, that's the lion's share of it. And we need to be much, much more critical about exactly what these things are and how they work and what kinds of differentials they introduce into the circumstances of our lives, what kinds of bargains and trade-offs they confront us with.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with London-based writer and urbanist Adam Greenfield. So you're describing these technologies like the smartphone as being this, I think in your words, roiling, contested terrain. But it sounds like, if I understand you correctly, you're saying it's not that there's a battle being waged on them, people sort of pushing back against the attempts to centralize control, collect information, commodify your information, but more that, if I follow you, that we think we're getting one thing out of it, and maybe we are, convenience and so on, even a sense of connection, and that they're taking something else out. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that is the case. I think that for too long, we've accepted that the sense of convenience or the sense of distraction or the sense of amusement or the sense of connection that we get out of network devices and services is something that we can be, that's something that we can have for free. That's certainly, you know, what the social network platforms has offered for us. You know, Facebook, I think, has a line, for example, it's like, it's free and it always will be. And that logic is disconcertingly close to the logic, of course, of a drug dealer. You know, the first hit is always free. They're making money off that transaction. They are profiting enormously from our use of it in ways that we ordinarily do not see. And as a matter of fact, we are fairly carefully prevented from seeing. There's an old saw in my business. There's an old kind of cliche at this point. It says that, you know, you're not the user, you are the product. And I think that is disturbingly close to the truth.
Let's talk about some of the other technologies, some which have been celebrated as being, as offering up sort of new vistas for us and what their downsides might be. And we will also talk about how do these things actually interact with each other. But tell us about 3D printing or 3D fabrication. What is it and what are the promises that are attached to it?
This is one of the technologies that I think offers a radically and fundamentally new bargain with the world, at least if it's evolved in a way that's consonant with that desire. 3D printing is a fascinating thing to watch. There's essentially a precision print head that glides across a plate, and it lays down a very, very thin layer of melted plastic filament. Basically, the print head is heating a plastic filament and melting it into layers. And by moving back and forth across the field and building up layer by layer by layer, it can construct some fairly elaborate objects, some extremely impressive, high-resolution, highly detailed objects, as long as you don't mind them being made out of this faintly greasy plastic. And what it offers us is two things at once. It offers us extremely detailed control over the arrangement of matter, and it offers us a context in which the means of production, that kind of dowdy Marxist 19th century sounding word, can genuinely be distributed and owned by people all over the world at relatively low cost. And I'll give you an example. Right now, I mean, these devices are still far too expensive for the average person. But right now, you can probably get a decent 3D printer capable of making objects of maybe a foot across, maybe a little bit less than that, for about $1,500 US. And when you consider that the cost of the material and the cost of the energy and the cost of your labor in putting things together, you can still make things for some small fraction of what they cost in the world on the open market.
And what sort of things are we talking about?
So far, sadly to me at least, it's fairly whimsical objects. But you can begin to make the components of larger and more complicated assemblies. You can make, let's say that you've had a table in your house that, you know, the leg has been wobbly for 30 years because there's a missing hinge. And, you know, you're on the verge of like taking the table to the Goodwill because you can't deal with it wobbling anymore. And it's been, you know, long out of production and there's no way on earth that you can get a hinge that works for it. You could probably like measure the hinge from the other legs and print one out in a 3D printer and fix the table and save it and restore it to active use in your home. You can make machine components. You can make working parts of working engines. And you can, in general, make anything that you imagine that is of that particular scale. Larger things can be built up from these components. But the most intriguing possibility of all is that with each 3D printer, you could, in principle, build another 3D printer. This was the original intention behind a project called RepRap. And the idea of the RepRap initiative was that everybody who had one of these things would immediately set about building another one, which would multiply the productive power that was available to people in the world exponentially. You know, the price would drop through the floor because there were simply so many of them in existence. And at that scale, really, you know, every block, every neighborhood workshop, everybody who wanted one could have one of these things for their own. Now, beyond plastic, things get really interesting. Digital fabrication is larger than merely 3D printing. And I should say that 3D printing has been, you know, used already with a variety of materials. There have been experiments made of 3D printing in concrete and even of living tissue. But beyond 3D printing, we have things like laser cutting and CNC or computer numerically controlled milling, which where the 3D printer is an additive process, right? It lays down layers and it builds things up, from smaller pieces. These other laser cutting and CNC milling are what we call subtractive processes. You need some feedstock. You need bar aluminum, bar stock. You feed that into a CNC mill, and it cuts things down to the component that's necessary with exactly the precision of the printer, even more so in some cases. So taken together, these approach something really profoundly disruptive in the world, if I can use that you know, just terribly overused word. The idea that each of us could make the things we need on demand, as and when we need them, for relatively low cost, working off of patterns that we download for free from repositories on the internet. So if we needed a shoe, you know, we could measure our feet and find a design and adapt it and print out a shoe of the right kind of material. And it might cost us a couple of dollars as opposed to, you know, the hundred or so dollars that a pair of sneakers might cost. This begins to etch away, to erode the commodity relationship that we have with so many things in our lives. And I think it begins to do something else beside that, which is recenter us in our own existence. Instead of thinking that the choices that are available to us are limited by what the market offers, we can begin to produce things locally, in tune with our own desires, and restore to ourselves a sense of very real, very material, very concrete control over the circumstances of our existence. There is a long way to go before we get there. And the reasons I go into in you know, abundant detail in the book, but what it amounts to is that the digital fabrication process is really just the tip of the iceberg. And below the waterline are the questions like the cost of energy and the cost of feedstock and the cost of assembly labor and the cost of the time that you put in to produce these things. And for all of the utopian thought that's already been dedicated to the digital fabrication revolution, relatively few people have taken a serious look at how you reduce the costs that are kind of below the waterline in this metaphor. It's trivial to print out things that you want, you know, on even an existing 3D printer. Whatever you should happen to be able to imagine, if it's of that scale and you can find a printer that can work in the materials that you're interested in working in. That's not the problem. The problem is, how do we harness this technical capability, this material capability, in a social and an economic context that offers it to more of the people in the world that are currently served by the existing market-oriented way of distributing goods and resources in the world?
Another area of technology that you write about in your book, Adam Greenfield, and the book in question is Radical Technologies, is that of augmented reality. Can you describe what you mean by augmented reality and then tell us why that is another sphere that raises concerns for you in terms of the way that technology shapes our everyday lives?
Sure. Augmented reality attempts to drop a pane of information over the visual view, over your forward view. And it emerges from a really interesting and very particular history. Basically, in the 1950s already, in the early 1960s, jet fighter pilots were finding that they couldn't integrate all of the information they needed to survive in aerial combat with the forward view when they were forced to look down at their instrument clusters. So technologists invented this thing called a head-up display, which projected information about the aircraft and about the combat situation directly onto the forward view. It superimposed luminous information that, you know, if you were a fighter pilot, you could look directly at and take in and not have to, you know, leave, you know, have your eyes even leave the forward view for a minute. And this fundamental metaphor turned out to be a really interesting way to approach annotating the world, superimposing useful information about the world over our forward view for the rest of us, even those of us who do not happen to be engaged in aerial combat at this moment in time. The best example, of course, the one that most everybody will be familiar with by now, is Pokemon Go. And the interesting thing about Pokemon Go is that instead of projecting that information onto a head-up display, onto a pane of glass that's situated between our eyes and the world around us, it uses our smartphone as the augmented object. So you hold the smartphone up in front of you, and using the camera on the smartphone and the screen of the smartphone, you're basically looking through a lens that offers you a view onto an alternate take on reality, an augmented reality, a reality with information about monsters and creatures and things that can't be perceptible to people who aren't using the augmented device, but are fully real and fully emotionally experienced for people who are sort of immersed in the interface, in the experience of using the augmenter. And that has, at least when Pokemon Go was briefly popular last summer, that has some really interesting consequences. It turns out that when, you know, people are engaged in an emotional experience like this, something that's really compelling, it overrides their sense of reality. You had people, knots of people, chasing the Pokemon monsters, you know, across streets and through busy intersections, because they found the journey so compelling. The alterity of the space that they were in the interface of their phone, was so much realer to them than the physical reality around them, that it was almost dangerous. That is how seductive this sense of augmentation can be. There were some wonderful things about this. Obviously, it got people moving. It got people active. It got people out into the city, even ordinarily sedentary people. And it encouraged a fair amount of social interaction. We had predicted that all of these things would happen, those of us who had been paying attention to this technology. For over a decade, we had been sort of waiting for augmented reality to find its moment. And in Pokemon Go, you know, the stars aligned. The technology was available. The metaphors were kind of assimilable in everyday culture. The platform existed to distribute the software, and all of a sudden people were having these really richly augmented experiences, you know, and then they weren't. And then the game sort of faded in popularity, and, you know, it's been months since I've seen anybody doing that. So it's a little bit weird to talk about the arrival of augmented reality at this point in time. I think most people remember the game, but it's already with a sort of fading and kind of embarrassed sense of like, oh yeah, that was something that was cool, you know, last year. Nevertheless, the technology itself is just about mature enough to appear across a spectrum of everyday experiences, not merely gaming experiences, but others in a weak way. You know, when people who happen to own cars that have this, you know, there will be a screen that replaces the rear view mirror. And as people are backing up, there will be like yellow guidelines that show you, you know, where it is safe to corner, where it is safe to back the car up. That's a form of augmented reality. For all of the progressive and positive and interesting things about this, though, there is a drawback. And the drawback is fairly major, which is that it takes us out of what I would call the shared reference platform of physical reality. We very, in a very literal way, we're no longer moving through the same world. If you are looking at the world through an augmented interface and I'm not. And I think that we have enough problems these days with, collectively that we don't share a reality, that I'm not sure this is a road that we want to go that much further down. Imagine that everybody that you encounter in everyday life is looking at the world through a different augmentation. How on earth are we, we're already having enough problems defining the situation in front of us, defining the political and economic contours of the situation in front of us. We're already having enough problems trying to come to some kind of even rough consensus about what our issues are and how we should best address those. Imagine how much more difficult that challenge to democracy becomes when we're fragmented into, a glittering infinity of shards of reality that don't really connect with any with one another at any point.
We've been talking about only a few of the technologies that seem to be defining our lives today. There are many other ones, of course, automation, self-driving cars. And I think a lot of us have the sense that our lives have been transformed so thoroughly by these technologies. But you argue that a lot of these technologies actually are not integrated with each other to the degree that they probably will be in the future if left to their own devices, so to speak. What would that look like? What will that look like?
You know, I would be foolish to make an assertion about that. That's why in the book I take a trick from the old futurists of the 1960s, and I instead posit five scenarios. I just don't think that there's any one unitary future awaiting us. I think that there are as many different futures as there are places on Earth, in a sense, and people to make these technologies their own. What I will say is that we are in the infancy of many of these things. And as you note, they're not particularly well integrated with one another yet. We can see things like, algorithmic data analysis beginning to infiltrate the other things that we encounter in everyday life. And it's very, very difficult to say with any confidence what that looks like when it's better integrated and more organic to something like 3D printing. What I will say is this: the fundamental terms on which we base our entire understanding of the economy and of politics and of life together are now subject to radical change from these emergent technologies. If the nature of a commodity, if the idea of material scarcity is under sustained assault, if the idea of a job and the relationship between employment and the production of value is under sustained assault, if the notion of togetherness and intimacy or of desire, if these things are beginning to melt away at the edges in the presence of predictive technologies and anticipatory technologies and technologies which seem to know us better than we know ourselves, then all of the foundational metaphors on which we base our entire society are going to be open to question in the next relatively short period of time. And I just don't think that any of us are truly prepared for that conversation. That's why I wrote the book. I want people thinking about these questions. I want people understanding the magnitude of the changes that we're looking at now. In my line of work, we have a position that's called techno-determinism, and it's generally thought of as sort of a clumsy or a clunky position, one that doesn't take account of the social world and of the agency and autonomy that we have as people. Techno-determinism basically says that, you can take a technology with a, like almost as if you're taking a medicine dropper and drop it into a situation, and it will autonomously change the rules of that situation. And I just don't think that is entirely true. Nevertheless, I do think that in looking at things like machine learning and digital fabrication and augmented reality. We are looking at things which profoundly begin to alter the terms of our being in the world and our being with one another. We still have a fair degree of flexibility as to exactly how we invite these things into our world, but that window is closing. And it is not likely to be wedged open any further by the credulous and uncritical admiration that we give to people like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. When they say, well, here, I've invented the future for you, here you can have at it. That's not the way that we need to be approaching these things. The stakes are far too high, and the implications for our own lives and our own ability to be in the world are far too major for us to be that cavalier about anything.
I wanted to end by asking you then, how would we go about shaping these things now? We do have a perception, I think a lot of us, that technology is a force outside of our control, unfolding under a logic that isn't social. Now, I think that is erroneous, but a lot of us do have that sense. And how would we intervene in shaping technology or limiting technology or doing whatever we think would benefit us the most at this point?
Yeah. The very first thing I would say is that we need to open up the question of technology and to never let it be settled. You know, they always say the greatest trick the devil ever played was convincing the world that he doesn't exist. And the same thing is true of what we call, quote unquote, technology. It is always a contest. It is always an arena in which different conceptions of the world are articulated and play out. And if we want not to have our degrees of freedom progressively reduced, we need to get inside that black box and open it up and force the power relations that are inscribed in these things to speak themselves and hopefully to alter them. The other thing I would say is that, and I address this particularly to people of what I would call the left political persuasion, please don't allow your eyes to glaze over whenever the question turns to one of technology. Please don't think that that is a question for somebody else. This is something that now does occupy the commanding heights of our existence, of our social and collective existence, and we need to understand it. I do not necessarily mean that everybody needs to learn to code. I find that a fatuous and a shallow and insulting suggestion. I just mean that we need, before we make the individual choice to use these products and services, we need to understand a little bit of something about how they work, how they function, what they do to us, what kinds of choices they present to us, and what kind of envelope of action they offer to us. I don't think that is too much to ask. I understand that we're all, most of us are exhausted most of the time, right? That is the bargain that we're offered by survival in late capitalism. And there is an aspect of, well, you know, here's more homework to do. And is this something else that I'm expected to shoulder responsibility for? And I guess in a way, my message is, yeah, this is something else that's really important. It is just as important as any other question of power we confront in our lives. And we need to not turn away from it. We need to look at it with open eyes and to get our hands dirty if we're going to have any chance of changing it.
Adam Greenfield, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
That's Adam Greenfield, author of Radical Technologies, The Design of Everyday Life, published by Verso. You can find a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. He's taught urban design at the Bartlett, University College London, and NYU. His other books include Everywhere and Urban Computing and Its Discontents. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain. We now turn to a highlight from an interview that I did with geographer Salvatore Engo Di Mauro, author of Soil, Science, and the Left, about the questions of resource scarcity, overpopulation, and the ideas of celebrity anthropologist Jared Diamond, author of Collapse. Environmental destruction is often explained as the consequence of overpopulation. On the left and the right, Harkening back to the ideas of Thomas Malthus in the 19th century, I asked Engel de Mauro about how he sees the relationship between overpopulation and the depletion of resources and soil degradation.
Thanks for that question, because it's one of those things that I consistently see in many situations of protests and whatever. And yes, as you say, it's really something that comes from the right wing. I mean, Malthus was a rather not exactly the most well-meaning reverend, you know, with respect to the working class in general. And people should read the originals to see how awful he was. Just to return to the peak soil argument and or peak resources argument, with peak soil, it's particularly evident that it's since we don't have even adequate monitoring worldwide, we have no idea what the peak is anyway. So, I mean, on a technicality, it's already out the window. But then to connect population growth to soil degradation, it's particularly problematic and has some and can have anyway some very nasty consequences with respect to leftist concerns, because first of all, if one is really serious about population growth, the first thing one should ask is why population is growing, and then dig up, you know, the social relations that are behind that, and that's one of the what's the first thing that should be asked. When one is concerned about population growth, instead of taking population growth as a given, as like Malthus did, and so, well, of course, you know, people always multiply. Of course, the working class, especially, they multiply like rats, and you know, they infest everything. Because that's where, you know, that comes from, that kind of logic. And then once it has been established that there is a population growth problem, even if it is, then one has to specify, well, how is it a problem relative to soil degradation? So what I've been finding is that, you know, people make population growth arguments, and then, well, where there's high population growth, well, empirically speaking, like in terms of the evidence, it's been found that sometimes you have degradation problems, and sometimes, like in northern Thailand and in parts of Kenya, you actually have the reverse happening. More people, more soil stability, less soil erosion. So it's that easy equation of, well, you have more people, therefore more resource consumption, therefore more destruction, fails to consider that people do useful things too for other organisms and for the rest of the ecosystem. We're not just destructive and just consuming things. And that's something that in the left, really, it needs to be expunged. Because otherwise, we're going to have, I can imagine a left-wing policy that then would make heavy demands on people to have less children. I mean, can you imagine that in a poor community where, you know, there's a history of genocide against them, you know, to demand of them to have less children? I mean, that's just awful in the first place. And that could be done through the left wing. In fact, it has been done through certain left-wing regimes. And that's why it's so important to eradicate that notion as soon as it comes up, and it has to be done effectively. Like, for example, hopefully that might be useful for people to say, well, why is the population growing in the first place? What's pressurizing people to have more children in the first place? And then we can get somewhere, maybe. And it already would take the issue of the environmental degradation out of the equation immediately by doing that. And then if the environmental degradation issue persists as a problem with higher population, then one has to make the connection, like prove it. Okay, what is it about having more people in an area that leads to soil degradation in that particular area? You see, population density, for example, does not necessarily mean that the soil is going to get degraded anytime soon. It depends on the soil types as well. It depends on the topography, and depends on many other factors. But also depends on what people actually do on the landscape. So that cannot be just taken for granted. So among other things. Otherwise, we would say, well, you know, Manhattan should be all like evacuated immediately because the soil there is completely destroyed. And even though there is no population growth per se, in fact, maybe there's a population decline in terms of percentages. But one wouldn't ask, you know, that question about Manhattan, would they?
Staying with how the left often sees soil degradation as part of a larger way of understanding environmental degradation, there are theories, and like those to do with population, they come from the right as well as the left, that link these things to civilizational collapse. Now, they're not necessarily separate from theories of overpopulation. They tend to be grouped frequently. But I wonder if you could talk about that notion, because, of course, for people on the left, obviously, great fear is that societies will ultimately collapse under the weight of environmental destruction. But you're arguing that a lot of these theories really are coming at these questions the wrong way.
Yeah, for me, it also comes to writers like Jared Diamond have popularized this notion too, and I've been very surprised that the likes of such arguments would be even entertained or like taken seriously in any leftist circle, because there are a couple of problems for me immediately. One is, how does one define civilization? And then when one looks back in history and one can even make the connection, which is really difficult to do, between environmental degradation and the collapse of whatever civilization one is looking into. Should we, for example, bemoan the slave-based societies like the Roman Empire? You know, if they really got wiped out because of environmental degradation, as some people, for some reason, make the argument, because empirically it's really thin evidence, but let's say that argument is right on the evidence. You know, it's like, okay, so the Roman Empire declines. Good riddance. So let's destroy the environment, and that way we can get socialism. Right? I mean, one could argue it the other way. So for me, that's problematic anyway. But then the issue of evidence is particularly one that for me is important, because these kinds of arguments are many of them are quoting people who just went out in landscapes like in Southwest Asia, and just based on observation, they said, oh, look, now this landscape is desolate, and it must be because the local inhabitants destroyed it, and so destroyed themselves. You know, these are observations that are based on very little evidence, and they get rehashed over and over again, and then picked up within the left as well, as, oh, well, this must have happened, without looking into the details about what evidence actually there is. And it's that particular approach, you know, taking, and it goes back to what I was saying earlier, you know, taking this stuff from the so-called experts, you know, uncritically, borrowing from them, you know, without looking in the details. And that's one of the downfall of one of the aspects in which you have a negative consequence, at least for leftists, you know, without doing that kind of, it's a painstaking kind of work. And that's why I guess maybe I can say that in academia, one can maybe have some legitimacy on the left, very little, but maybe this is one of them. I mean, we can do this kind of work of detail, you know, like digging, and that can be helpful to deflate these arguments. Then the other aspect of civilization is what I said earlier, like, what is a civilization anyway? And this also needs to be asked, just like, you know, why is the population growing? Well, what is a civilization? And why should we be concerned whether civilization collapses or not? Of course, the primitivists would say, yeah, fantastic, civilization collapse. But of course, they're not advocating for environmental destruction in order to achieve that end. They're coming from a different angle. Those who are concerned about civilization, on the other hand, oftentimes do not define what they mean. So that would the Haudenosaunee Confederacy be a civilization just like the Qin Empire in present-day China, or the Maya polities in present-day Yucatan and Petén or elsewhere? And that begs the question as to, well, what kind of society does one really want to live in? And then once we have that sorted out, then what is the relationship between these different kinds of societies and their environments? And if we can't answer those questions, then why even bother with this civilization idea if we're not even really clear about what we want, you know, in terms of our future society? And we're just taking all these different societies and saying, oh, they collapse because of environmental degradation. And there might be societies that we abhor, that we never want to live in. And so why should we be concerned necessarily? So that's another aspect for me that's problematic, aside from the very, very thin evidence at best for linking environmental degradation with civilization collapse. I mean, most civilizations, if they collapsed at all, whatever that means, because that's another problem. Like, what does it mean it's collapsed? For the Maya, for example, well, they never collapsed. The problem is the Spanish settlers and the conquest and the genocide. That's the problem. Not that they collapsed. It wasn't like they destroyed the environment and they were like gone before the Spaniards came in. So, you know, these kinds of discussions too, like, fail to consider a lot of indigenous people's perspectives too, which I find very problematic on the left.
And that was an interview that I did with geographer Salvatore Engo Di Mauro. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.